if we don't change, it's going to stay the way it is. And for most of us, that would be not a very good thing. That we would freeze our lives and freeze the issues that are in our lives for the rest of our lives. Most of us would not want that. If I removed, if I had a magic wand that could remove the problems that each of us have in this room right now, just remove the problems, but don't change any of the underlying mechanisms that we have in our lives, and then we had this meeting 5 years from now, most of us would have recreated an identical set of problems in our lives. If I took away every sexual, technical, financial, marital, social, work issue that we have in our lives, most of us would recreate those conditions in our lives over the next subsequent period of time. We need to know that. We need to know that we have brought a knife to a gunfight, that our minds are in charge of our lives, and what we need is access to who we are at our deeper level. We need access to being. We need access to God. We need access to the power within. Most of us are using our minds to run our lives. Most of us have had problems that we have filed on our hard drive as solutions. They're in the computer as answer, not problem. You wonder why we keep going back to the same thing. We have programmed it like it's an answer, like anger is an answer, because it worked at different periods of time in our lives. It will keep people away. As you get older, it gets worse and it screws up relationships, something horrible. But when you're 13 or 14 or 15 years old, when you're programming the machine, anger and intimidation looks like a tool. I got guys I sponsor and their whole toolbox is just full of hammers, different size hammers, big hammers, small hammers. When the only tool you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And that's what we do. We keep bringing the same tools to the same situations, trying to get a resolution, and they don't work. We need a change, but the change is profound. One of the things our book talks about is that the change that we're talking about in the program is transformational. It is not linear. It is not just an improvement. It is like taking us to a different place and replanting us. It is making the discovery that what we are in essence is God in drag. That who we are at the core of our being, what we're looking for, as Chuck used to say, we're looking with. That the angst, that the feeling of separation we have had is a feeling of separation from God. That once we come reconnect with the core of our being, when we reconnect with the source of our power, when we reconnect with the God of our understanding, it will be a process of coming home. As Ken said, we were sent out from the original equipment manufacturer in good shape. There is nothing missing. The process of finding God is not a process of addition. It is a process of subtraction. It is a process of removing what is in the way, and it is a process of discovering certain things of who we are and what life is about. And who we are is not our identity, and that I think is the most difficult, most profound piece of information that we can have. Most of us have spent our lives thinking we're the Chevrolet, and we get in a better paint job, more chrome, buffing it up, washing it off, driving it up and down University Avenue, and we think that the new seat covers, all the different, new sound system, all the different things we can do to that, and as we improve that, who we are is better. We're the driver. We are not the Chevy. And the drivers are all the same. You know that movie Cocoon? You know, when they took off the suits that they had that made them boys and girls and different people, that they were all the same? I think at the level of spirit, we are all the same. You know, when someone says, snap your fingers and says, how old are you? Internally. You know, almost everybody is like 20 to 35. You know, there's something, your spirit doesn't age. Internally, there is a spirit inside of each one of us, and it is the same. We are not the difference. We are not the skin bag is the vehicle. It's a spacesuit. It is necessary. You got to get issued a spacesuit and an ego to take the trip. You do. It's necessary. But a lot of it is baggage. It is your vehicle. Your vehicle will put you in front of different things. But who you are in essence is the spirit. It is not the vehicle. Now you have to treat the vehicle nicely. You can't get rid of the vehicle. You can't get rid of the ego. You can't get rid of the body. So it's part of the original equipment manufacturer package. But what we have to do is get connected to the power of God within. And once you have that connection with the Spirit, an awful lot of the things that we are afraid of starts to dissolve. And we can start to be present to life in a way that we have not been present to life before, because we are not affected by our history. And we're not always having to jump off into some sort of phenomenal thing that's going to take us to salvation. That we can actually pay attention to what's going on in our life today. That we're not lacking or missing anything. And when we get in tune with that power, we can start to receive the power and put it in action in our life. It has never been lack of talent for most of us. One of the most frustrating things that I have seen in Alcoholics Anonymous is it isn't like we're ill-equipped in the process of living life. Many of us are equipped wonderfully well. We just can't put it to use over any extended period of time because we have things that are impeding that operation. So finding God and finding peace is a process of removal, not of addition. Finding out what is in your way and what doesn't work. And that, in most ways, is what I think the process of life is about. I think it's the process of what the program is about. As you can open your eyes and really start to take a look at what's in your life, the universe will present you a message, and the message will be, it doesn't work. It's not working. When you look in your spouse's eyes and you see the look, the universe is saying, it's not working. When you look in your child's eyes and they're afraid of you, the message is, it's not working. When you get fired, the message is, it's not working. When your relationship gets broken up and you're going away, the message is, it's not working. Most of us want a different messenger. We want a different message. We'll change the circumstance. We'll find a new person. We're going to adapt the world to meet our idea of the world. We're going to reduce the world and only put people in it we'll put up with our crap. Okay. We're not going to adjust ourselves to the world. Well, the true process of growth and the true process, I think, of the program is to open yourself up to life and to take on the messages that life gives you. And if you cooperate with that and really take it on, what you will be moving towards, and I think this is the key, you'll be moving towards love. If you want to see if the program's working in your life, go to the other people in your life, your friends, your family, your employer, the people in your meetings, your sponsor, and say, hey, is Harry becoming more loving? Maybe you don't see that immediately, but over a long period of time, when I take a look at someone who's been in the program for 10 or 15 years, if I was looking one place, that would be the place I'd be looking to.
Well, when it comes to love, there's no doubt in my mind that love is the most powerful force in the world. There's no force more powerful than it. And John of the Cross, who was one of the great spiritual writers at one time when he was alive, said, where there is no love, put love, and then you'll find love. And I think it's probably the strongest spiritual statement I've ever heard. And that is, if you see love missing in a situation, you yourself put it in there and then you'll find it. It's not about the other person at all. It's simply about being able to accept life on life's terms. And the other thing I know is that, you know, I sponsor a lot of guys who are looking for a custom fit in an off-the-rack world. And, you know, they're running around trying to find somebody who's perfect. And unfortunately, they're bumping into women who are looking for the same thing. So they just bypass each other, you know. And then they wonder why they're alone in the world. You know, there are no perfect people. There are just people who are doing the deal a day at a time. As I said before, I feel that there's like some real themes in the book that we don't spend enough time on. Energy is one. Love is another one. The guys who wrote this book talk about it in the 10th step, where they say love and tolerance will be our code. Well, They threw the tolerance in there knowing the people they're going to be dealing with. Very judgmental alcoholics. Very judgmental. Not this group, but, you know, obviously. But the others, you know, those others who aren't here, they're very judgmental. And that's why they put love and tolerance in there, because they knew initially you'd be doing more, praying more for tolerance than love, because you don't know what love is. But eventually, when you get to that point where you are consumed with love, and love comes from being willing to go all the way, and we're just not willing to go all the way. In the sixth step, it talks about, to me, another theme in the book which we don't talk much about is fire. You know, you're going to have to be consumed. Life is like a fire, and God is a fire. It's a mystical fire. And most of us, as we go towards the fire, there's two kinds of people. There's the people who walk right into the fire and get totally consumed and disfigured by it. They can never go back to who they were. It's impossible. They've been, as Bob said, transformed. And then there's the rest of us. We hang out around the fire where we can stay warm, but we just don't want to get burnt. And the deal is, that's what has to happen. You have to get burnt. You know, it's not by accident. When I read about the spiritual fire of consumption, and then I read the big book, they're right in tune. When Ebby went to see Bill, Bill describes Ebby as what? A man on fire. And stood in front of me was a man who's on fire. Ebby at that time had the fire. And he had it so powerfully that Bill couldn't deny it. In front of me is a man on fire. Bill, in passing on. The fact that he took religious instructions, thinking of turning to converting to Catholicism with then Monsignor Fulton Sheen. And he said, what I really wanted out of life, which they weren't able to give me, were little bits of spirituality that I could consume easily, and I wanted the fire to keep warm with, never being consumed. And that's the deal. It's like, you know, when you're growing up, and I'm sure it's more profound here in Minnesota where you get some tough winters, but back east, my mom used to say to us constantly when we opened the door, either come in or what? Go out. You're letting the heat out. So either come in or go out. Make a decision. If you have your friends and you want to talk, either go outside and talk to them or bring them inside. But don't do what? Stand in the door and vacillate. And that's what we do, because we want the idea of the result of being consumed by the fire, but we also know at the same time it means we can never be who we pretend to be now. You can't be both. Just can't be both. And that's why people who are consumed by it don't have to tell you. You just know they're consumed. There's no language for the experience of being consumed by the fire of love. We use all the wrong words because we don't have any words. People try to explain something that they don't even understand. And it's impossible. If you have experienced God in your life, the minute you try to verbalize it, it loses. It loses all its content because it's your experience. It's your taking something that becomes now a part of you and will always be a part of you, whether you're conscious of it again or lose that consciousness for a while. You know, and the master who sent us out, you know, he understands that. And I hear people say the most profound, dumb things. It's almost like they all got through school unscarred by education. But they say things like, well, I'm not different. Everyone in here is different. We weren't made off the Ford assembly line. You know, every one of us is a model that since the beginning of time has been expected. And there'll never be another one like us. Take my word for it. Our fingerprints are not the same. You know, our footprints are not the same. Our DNA is 98% the same, but that 2% differential allows people to tell this person from that person. The fact that through all the millennia that have gone before, we're still 98% the same DNA means we all came from the same place. And we get these things in our ideas. I remember hearing Malcolm X speak in New York when he was quite profound at doing that. And he said something that always has stayed with me.
He said, it's not about what people call you. It's about what you answer to. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, sometimes we create this deal that you're less than, you're not the same. And that's really a very, very negative place to start from. We have enough baggage. All you have to do to see our baggage is read Dr. Silkworth. You know? Well, here's this little group, and we're going to make some general statements about them. Number one is they're maladjusted to life. They're outright mental defectives. You know, they're in full flight from reality. They're children of chaos and producers of confusion in their best moments. You know, this is a lot of baggage to start with. And in there, you're trying to scrape away those levels and get to who you are. And who you are is somebody who was sent out okay. And your reason you know you're okay is because if you weren't okay, you wouldn't be here. You're okay. We always have been okay. We always will be okay. We're sitting on a pendulum on a clock that's been wound for eternity. We have absolutely nothing to do and forever to get it done. That should not create a lot of pressure.
But most of us really know those words, but that's not our experience. We don't feel okay. We don't feel equipped. We don't feel like we have all eternity. It's not okay, and I'm not okay. I was born with that feeling. That's part of what alcohol took away. We don't feel like we're part of God. We feel like we're separate. We feel like we're in competition. We feel like we are under-equipped in the business of living life. With an external view, it is not surprising that then our solutions we're looking for are all external. We're looking for faster horses, younger women, and more money. Or if you're a guy, or you know, however that goes, we're looking for more. We're looking for more. Our society today, the god of our society is psychology. This feeling, if we get in touch with our feelings and understand it better, somehow we will resolve it. Psychology is not deep enough to resolve the issues that we're talking about. Spirituality touches at a much deeper level than psychology. Insight is not enough to touch what we're looking for. What do we want? Most of us want happiness. You heard a great distinction about happiness. Happiness is dependent upon our perception that circumstances are positive. Peace and joy are not. Our book is just full of the word of peace and joy, of serenity. What we're looking for is of God. It is not circumstantial. Circumstances will not bring this. It is not external. But the world tells you it is external. The world tells you get more and it will be okay. More money. You know, make your body different. Make, you know, be thinner. Be richer. You're not okay. The message is endemic in our society as we are spending billions of dollars in our society trying to keep people on the edge and keep them uncomfortable. We are wanting machines with the idea that if we get something different, it'll then be okay. So clearly, even though we may know the words, that the God of our understanding is the answer, that we lack the power. What we want is the peace that surpasses understanding. But what most of us want is money and things. Most of us, when we're connected to our minds, we have constantly... The ego and the mind are in charge. It is an obsessive thinking, and there's an internal, the committee is meeting, and there is an internal message about what we need to be okay, and we now don't have it. So when Wadsworth said that most people lead lives of quiet desperation, he was speaking about all of us. Most of us in some sort of way, even though we have had modicums of success, that most people in the day-to-day business of living. Most of us have some internal sense of desperation, and it's not okay. And so what we're talking about is finding some peace beyond that, a resolution beyond that. That model is bankrupt. That model, when Ken said, when the guy comes to him and says, I'm thinking about committing suicide, and he says, perfect. Couldn't get a better entry point. Okay? What do you have to do to get well? You have to do much. Just to die and change everything in your life. Other than that, it's okay. It's very simple. But, I mean, that's the answer. What do you have to do? Oh, die. Died to self. What do I have to change? Everything. But he said, what he lost, he thought he lost his treasure, but he had it all the time. Most of us, our perception of the world, if we got what we wanted, it would still not be okay. Having more of what we now have is not going to make it okay. We need a different paradigm. Most of us are saying, hey, it's over here. Most of us want to look where the lamppost is, because we think the light's better. That's where we lost our keys. You know, we know we lost them over here in the dark, but we can't see over there, so we aren't going to go over there. Okay. It's a different paradigm. It's a shift. The model that we have and the model that the world gives us does not work. Doing it faster, doing it harder, doing it more, doing it longer, finding the perfect sponsor, getting into an intensive group situation, getting into an intensive step group. These things may assist. They may actually be part of the process of you expending yourself so that you run out of yourself, so that you get to surrender, where you can finally open it up. The answer is to find a power greater than yourself. The reason that the energy is there is that is who you truly are. At the core of your being, you are connected. At the core of your being is a knower. You know what to do. When you are connected to that core of your being, it is okay. The reason we are experiencing pain is that a pain is we are unwilling to accept the world and ourselves the way it is. We cannot be in the presence of life the way it is. So we can't interact with it. We're in judgment of it. We have pain about it. We're in reaction to it, but we don't do anything about it. We're paralyzed with it. We just have this ongoing commentary about what is going on with life, but we cannot powerfully interact with it because we can't be with it. What happened? The moment that we finally got to a point where we could be with our alcoholism, we started to implement a cure. Prior to the fact we surrendered, we could not be with our alcoholism, and our alcoholism managed us. What you can be with, you can manage. What you can't be with manages you. And most of us cannot be with most of the problems in our lives. They are problems by definition because we cannot be present to them. If we were able to be present to them, they'd just be circumstances. But the reason that we're so resistant to them, we create them as problems, and we have absolutely no resolution to them. Even though we would know what action we could take to resolve those circumstances.
In Bill's story in the Big Book, he makes mention of the fact that he says, "Surely this must be the answer, self-knowledge." And then the very next sentence starts, "But it is not." You know, knowing what to do and doing it are two entirely different things. And that's why we live in a world where, hopefully in Alcoholics Anonymous, we gain enough insight to know that if you don't like the way things are, you're going to have to take some actions. And constantly inventorying the same stuff is not taking an action. Constantly going to anyone to seek advice about it is not taking an action. Taking an action is taking an action. You know, if you were on fire, you know, you'd want to put it out before you really talked about it with anybody else. You know, but that's not the way we go. And the way we go is the way we go. And the reason for that is simply because we've come to accept that. And that's why you have to start with a basis of saying, I'm going to allow for some change in my life. And that change is not going to be goal-oriented. It's going to be, I'm going to allow life to come and work me over. And that means a lot of times doing things that initially seem very uncomfortable. There was a certain sense of ease in my life when I first got sober, and I had absolutely no material things at all. I'll tell you, those first few months of sobriety were terrific for me. I had nothing. Everybody knew my story. It had already been in the papers, so I had done a fifth step publicly. You know,
the bottom line was, is I had nothing to hide. There was no lie to tell because everybody already knew the truth. And what happened was along the way, I began to gain a false sense, once again, of who I was, and that began to put the space between God, as I understand him, and myself. God is just nothing more to me today than a consciousness. I don't have to have anyone explain that as an entity. I don't have to know what comes next. My sense of ease knows in coming from the fact that I've been okay since I got up this morning, and I'll be okay. And the reason I'll be okay is because I'm not looking to do anything else that involves harm to anybody else. I'm not planning ahead to anything else. I'm just sitting here. And Bob mentioned before that you don't have any problems in the now. We suffer from a spiritual malady. And I never knew what that spiritual malady was until about 2.5, 3 years ago. And then it became very evident to me what that spiritual malady is for me. And that spiritual malady is I had spent the better part of my life trying to live where I couldn't live, either in the past full of guilt and remorse or in the future a projection of phantom fear. I was never in the moment. And the minute I began to adapt my life to living in the moment, I realized that all of those things just went away. They were not real. And the reason they went away is because this is where God lives. God lives in the moment. It's not by accident that we have a sentence in the big book that says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him Thursday. You know? God being in the now means that if I'm there, the spiritual malady doesn't have a hold of me. I'm just doing what's expected of me. And what's been expected of me since the beginning of time. And when I'm not living there, I'm living in that separation that was talked about. You cannot be separate and at the same time be a part of. You know, there's a saying that comes out of the East, and it goes like this, and it says, there is no way to happiness. Happiness is the way. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. And there is no way to enlightenment. Enlightenment is the way. And when I first heard that, I knew it was profound, but I didn't know what the application was. And now I do. It's our triangle. It's our triangle, the legacy of AA, the three legacies. My happiness has come in doing what? Being of service. The more service I do, the happier I am. My peace has come in being in unity with my fellow man. You can't have a fight with me or a tug of war with me because I refuse to hold my end. There's no resistance. You do what you have to do. And then the enlightenment has come. If I wasn't in recovery, I wouldn't stand a chance of being here and talking about the things we're talking about. I'd be out doing the things that would prevent me from being here. So life gets as complex or as simple as you want it to be. You know, if you want to create a habit, you have to repeat an act. It's just that simple. It's amazing to me. I sponsor guys who are good golfers. They have handicaps or no handicaps, and they talk about it almost like continually. And they give up a certain amount of time to become really, really good golfers, because my understanding is it doesn't come easy. And the thing is how much time do you allocate for the things we're talking about? Today is like a 4-hour day or a 5-hour day, whatever. But how much time ongoing is allocated in that area? If you get up in the morning and you have a legal pad and it has an agenda on it for the day, then where's God's agenda? How does God get into your agenda if you've already got the whole day planned? Where do you say, I want God to come into my life, but, geez, I only got this 15 minutes here between this and this. I can tell you, having volunteered in the hospice program for 10 years and holding the hands of a lot of people, really, really nice people, and watching them die and watching them ease out of this world into whatever comes next, on a given day, they had an agenda, things they thought were important. And the very next day, when they knew they were going to die, that agenda changed. Everything that was on this piece of paper became crap. it had no application to the reality they were now in. And the idea is, if you can get rid of that agenda that easily at that point, why not toss it aside now? Why not get down to what's really real now and not have to wait for the last few days, if you get those days? Sometimes you don't even get those days. So why not set aside the time to do it now? I just know that people who are trying to pursue a conscious contact with God never fail. There's always success in the ratio of attempts that you put into it. No effort in this area ever goes to waste. None. What the little bit you do, poquito, whatever it is, it goes to the good. You know, when I was out there on the reservation with the Navajo, they had a great saying, and that is, you know, if you do a rain dance long enough, you get rain. And my Navajo name was Quick Clock, which means white pony man. And I was the white pony man. And I went from place to place. And what I found out is people who in the material sense have absolutely nothing, to be connected with nature is an unbelievable thing. An unbelievable thing. I'm a kid from New York. I never saw a whole lot of nature. But up there on the San Juan River, I had the experience of sitting there for 2 days and watching eagles come down out of the sky and take trout out of the San Juan River. And those trout are just cruising along thinking things are good. You know, the guys are over here fly fishing. I'm over here. Everything's looking good. I'm just cruising along. They don't know what? That the end is bearing down. And suddenly you just see them hit that water, those talons go out, and that fish is gone. And folks, that could happen to us at any time. Any time. And the bottom line is, if you want to be good to go, you got to get ready. And getting ready means doing less and less. I don't think there's a person in here who would argue with the fact that if you want the things of this world, you have to speed up. If you want the things we're talking about, you have to slow down. You have to make a choice. It's a conscious choice on a daily basis. Do you want to speed up and be more and more in the competition? Or do you want to slow down and have life in all of its abundance? The abundance of life is its own abundance. It doesn't need any add-ons. You know, did you ever see a hearse go by with a U-Haul attached to it? You know? Do you ever see a hearse with luggage racks? You know, speaks to itself.
Is this microphone working? We're going to stop now for lunch.
I wanted to read a couple of definitions of words. We've been doing some talking about transformation and about being, and we've used the word enlightenment. And our book talks about awakening, and I thought rather than being too obtuse, it might be helpful just to read a couple of definitions. I'm reading this out of a book called The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. And in one place he defines enlightenment as your natural state of felt oneness with being. Because sometimes we get an idea of that you really got to be, woo, you know, really out there, and, you know, that it's only available to people in a monastic setting after, you know, very prolonged practice over a long period of time. But his definition of enlightenment is your natural state a felt oneness with being. It is essentially you, and yet it is much greater than you. It is finding your true nature beyond name and form. He defines being as, it is the eternal, ever-present one life beyond the myriad forms of life that are subject to birth and death. The eternal, ever-present one life beyond the myriad forms of life that are subject to birth and death. And in this book, he uses the word being interchangeably with God. He said we have so we have so, such strong feelings about the word God that it has almost become that we can, oh God, I know God. We just have this, you know, we have so much information and thinking about it that sometimes when we use the word being, we cannot shut that down as much as we can sometimes shut down and close what we mean in our minds by God. And it says being, it says this means that it is accessible to you now at your deeper self, your own true nature. But don't seek to grasp it with your mind. Don't try to understand it. You will know it only when your mind is still. And one of the questions people have been coming up and asking is, how do you enlarge your concept of God? How do you enlarge your experience of God? And one, I believe in many ways that the language of your higher power is silence. And that what is in the way of many of us experiencing God is our compulsive, obsessive, addictive thinking. And that we have to find a way to reduce that noise and to start to have some access to some sort of silence or space in which to experience God. One of his other definitions of enlightenment is it a state of wholeness and being at one and therefore at peace, at one with life in its manifest forms, the world, as well as your deepest self and the unmanifest forms, which is being. What is in the way of the experience of being and what is in the way of the experience of enlightenment in great substance is our thinking. It is our mind. So when we try to contain God in words, you know, you can't contain God in words. The words point. Someone said is that when the master points to the moon, all the idiot sees is the finger. Because words are signposts. You know, they literally point to something that is transcendent, to something that is beyond themselves. And we need to realize that, I think, sometimes in the big book that, you know, everybody says, read the black part. You know, like, you know, all you got to do is read 164 pages and you'd be enlightened. And the fact is, I believe that that is of God, and I believe it is so, but I believe it is very profound. And I believe that those words, often what they point to is beyond what the words themselves say. And sometimes we accept just as long as we know the words, we think we have the message and we think we have the experience and we don't. So in order for many of us to, so we're sober, we're in AA, we're doing the steps, and many of us are stuck. How do you get unstuck? Surrender is the solution, but that's not easy. That's transformational. Just can't snap your fingers and bring that one into a command to be at your fingertips. But we should be able to access it. I think with a certain attitude and with a certain persistence, with the rain dance philosophy that Ken talked about, is that if you do a rain dance long enough, you will have rain. I believe that the fact that we search for God pleases God. I believe that if we, when Ken talked about your schedules being full, someone said, how do you find God? Well, it's a search. What do you do? I mean, I don't know. I read 5 books a year that, you know, are, have some spiritual content or some, you know, some direction of someone who's a little further down the path than I am that has given me. I have tapes that I listen to on a regular basis that, you know, kind of, you know, are pregnant with ideas and philosophies that, you know, kind of titillate my mind and my hunger for God. I have a spiritual director who I talk to regularly, and the only purpose of that talk is to have a conversation about how I am. And the book said that probably no human power could have relieved her alcoholism, and God could and would if he were sought. And you ask yourself the question, how much time do you spend seeking God? You know, I asked myself that question when I was 8 years sober, and I didn't like the answer. And I believe that going to meetings is seeking God. I believe that talking to your sponsor is seeking God. But at some point, I asked myself that question. Bob, how much time do you spend seeking God? And the answer I got back was not much. I mean, and I was going to a lot of meetings, and I was a pretty active member of AA. And I started then to add to my reading program. I started then to have people that I had more specific spiritual conversations with. I go to a couple of retreats a year. I go to, you know, I probably talk at 12 or 14, 15 roundups a year, but I also attend 4 or 5 conferences and roundups that I don't speak at. You know, so I'm probably every other weekend I'm at a conference listening to people talk about the program in recovery. We get a lot of stimulation with that. I mean, sometimes if all you're doing is going to the same 2 or 3 AA meetings with the same people that you do, you can, and sometimes you lose the wonder of that, and it can start to feel stagnant. Once in a while, when I get guys that get a little bit flat, I say, do something different. I mean, go to a group you've not been to. Do something that you cannot neutralize or negate before you even go to do it. Do something that you don't know in your mind, you know, that has some expectation to do that. So if you are what you fill yourself full of, do not be surprised. The world, if you're filling yourself full of the world, you're going to be neurotic. You're going to be looking for the answer outside. You're going to be unhappy with yourself. You are not going to be centered. You're not going to be at peace. You're going to be in trouble if you're full of the world. You need to get centered. The only peace that you're going to have on an ongoing basis, the only ability to be grounded and to be connected with life, is not one that is mind and ego-based. It is God-based. In order to do that, you have to kind of step aside from your identification with your mind. The freedom that I have had, if you ask my wife or my children, they would still kind of laugh. I'm kind of spring-loaded, head first, 60 miles an hour, no helmet. I know I look like a burnout old guy, but there was a time when I didn't always look like this. I just haven't taken care of the vehicle. But we have done some travel. And why did I bring that up? Just absolutely burned out. Just kind of. Yeah. We're going to come back.
Yeah. I know that feeling. What used to be a senior moment has now become rolling blackouts. So I understand that very, very well. You know, what I heard Bob saying is that, you know, you can spend so much time, and it's very, and unfortunately, when you look around the world today, this is what's happening. People have beliefs, and belief means you don't know. Belief means you're going with what someone told you, and you don't really know. And the other thing is that people are so concerned with the image of God that once you get beyond the image of God to the essence of God, everybody seems to be on the same page. You know, God is love and all the other good things that we talk about. But we're so busy forming an image of him or her or whatever that we lose out on the essence part. And God is too good to be reduced to an image. You know, and if we could imagine God as he really is, then he wouldn't be God. You know, it's got to be beyond us. I know he has a good sense of humor. Anybody who would give man his sexual peak at 18 and women hers at 40 is somebody who likes to tinker. You know, as you know, I know that God likes to laugh, and I know the other thing is that when, like, you folks are laughing now, I also know that you cannot laugh and think at the same time. It's impossible. So every time you laugh, you're getting a respite from your favorite topic, which is you. And I know another thing about laughter, which ties in with what we were talking about all morning, is the fact that the reason that something, first of all, man is the only animal in the animal kingdom that can laugh, because we're the only animal in the animal kingdom that can see the absurdity of something. And the other thing is the fact that when someone is telling you a joke, our minds are so trained that they're not in the moment. Our minds are incapable of being in the moment. So when someone is telling you a joke, or me a joke, we're leapfrogging to what we think is the next logical thing. And when the punchline comes, it's totally illogical. And it actually tricks our mind, because our mind has jumped to what it perceives will be the answer, and the answer is totally out of sync. Now, if you laugh at the same joke a half a dozen times, then, you know, you need help beyond this room. So, but the reality is that's why something is funny. And someone said about the logic of something, you know, there is no logic in this world. There is no logic. If this were a logical world, men would ride side saddle. And we don't. You know, just there's absolutely no logic. And that's the mind game, is that you give the mind the most important thing that any one of us does, any one of us, is the way we see ourselves, because it's within the context of how we see ourselves that we're going to evaluate everything else. Our mind is going to go to great lengths to prove us right in every scenario, and it's going to go to great lengths to prove that we're seeing it correctly, and the other folks just happen to be confused at the moment. And in so doing, it feeds back to us what it needs to sustain itself. Not what we need to sustain ourselves, but what it needs to sustain itself. And that's when God becomes the primary purpose of your life, then what happens is the mind becomes very secondary. We wouldn't take, you know, when people say to me, you know, I go to meetings and I say, well, when I get up in the morning, my mind's waiting for me, and it, you know, it has me doing things. If you are acting out your life like that, then it is not your mind. You're its body. It's not your mind. You wouldn't take that crap from your hand. You know, if your hand said, I'm going to do this on your own, you say, wait for me. You know, like, hey, you wouldn't have a hand going off doing something you didn't want it to do. But you let the mind do that because it's in charge, and it leads you to believe that this is in your best interest. And the minute you start to get into the spiritual realm and you start to open the doors that have never been opened before, then the essence of God comes in and you begin to realize that this mind is a tool. It's just like your foot or your eyes or your nose. It should be used as a tool. It shouldn't be running my life. I rented a car about a year ago. It was the first experience I had with this, and it had one of those global positioning systems on it, and I punched it in, and it snowed where I was at, so I thought, well, I'll run it through the car wash. It was a rental car, and I ran it through the car wash, and in so doing, I came out of the car wash in the wrong direction. And I made another turn, which put me even further away from the direction I should have been going. And suddenly this voice came on, and it says, please follow direction. And I thought, God, if I had had this at 16 or 17, you guys wouldn't even see me. I mean, if I got that immediate response to, like, hey, what you're doing is incorrect. And then I realized that I've needed a sponsor from the time I was a child. You know, I needed a sponsor in kindergarten. You know, I needed someone to say, you know, call out from the kindergarten and have them say, Ken, relax, you know, eat the cookies, take the nap, you know. I needed a lot of hands-on, and I just, you know, had I gotten that, I think it would have put me in a whole other deal. But I was left to my own devices, and my own devices were very selfish and self-centered. This entire big book, which I like to refer to as the Owner's Manual, is not about freedom of self anymore, because I did that when I was drinking. I had freedom of self. And this is freedom from self. This is a whole different... This is a whole way of going at life that's different than the way I've used before. And the reality of going at it from a whole different perspective is the fact that it's going to open up doors and windows that were never opened before. God is screaming to come into my life. And I'm running around. You know, if you want a visual of me, I'm a man standing on a whale fishing for minnow. You know, that's who I am. I got this unbelievable thing that's accessible to me, and I'm spending my time doing other things. And what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous, it happens at me at meetings when they start to read how it works, is somehow I get pulled into that moment. You know, I just seem to get pulled in there. I have no defense against the next meeting. I'm very fortunate. I just go. And in going, what happens is I get dragged, at least for that period of time, into the moment. And the reality here is that I have a friend who just came back from being in Iran, which is, I know, not a good empire, supposedly. But AA is now 4 years old over there. And wonderful, unbelievable things are happening. Al-Anon, they have 18 Al-Anon meetings now in Tehran. And he just came back and he cried. And he said, Ken, in the mosque, the women are not allowed to go and pray. And yet they can come to AA meetings. And in these very mosques, with the picture of the Khomeini hanging up there, he must be having a great time with this. There they are in there, and they're reading How It Works and doing a regular AA meeting. This thing is unbelievable. You know, this thing is unbelievable. Bill and Bob, I talked to Bob's son about this one time, and he said, you know, had my dad been in charge of this thing, we'd still be meeting at my house in Akron. He said, and if Bill had been in charge of it on his own, he said, we'd be franchised like McDonald's. He said, but somehow God in his infinite wisdom put the blend of both of these men together. And in that blend has come this deal. I mean, every time I look out at an AA group, from being on a podium or behind a stage, I'm just amazed. I'm thinking, the number of people with the number of stories, it's too bad we just don't have time to go around the room and have everybody give their story, because that's really the deal that got you here. And every time I hear someone share, they get to a certain point in their story, whether they be the speaker behind the podium or the speaker from the floor or just someone sharing, they get to the same critical point. And when they get to that point, they'll say, something happened. It doesn't have to be defined. We're too much into definitions. It doesn't have to be defined. When you say to me, something happens, I know what happened. You know what happened. The words become very secondary. The fact that you were doing something that you couldn't stop doing, and now you're doing something completely different, is all the evidence you need to know that some force greater than yourself intervened.
A complete psychic change. So if you are suffering from alcoholism, you may be suffering from a condition that only a spiritual experience can cure. The great fact is this, and nothing less, that we have had deep, effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today, with absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous, He has commenced to accomplish those things for us that we could never do for ourselves. And when we talk in other places in the book about when Jung is talking to Hazard, and he says, here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. They appear in the nature of large emotional displacements and rearrangements. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes that were once the guiding forces of our lives are suddenly cast aside, and a completely new set of conceptions and motivations begin to dominate them. I mean, that's not linear. That is like a sex change operation. Ideas, emotions, attitudes, which were once the guided forces of the lives of these men and women, are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. Time and time again, this book talks about the problem, and then all of a sudden it says, suddenly, at once. You know, and that is the action of God. It is, you know, the problem is removed. It is lifted. It is just extraordinary. I remember now what I was trying to do before, which I'm going to go to. Drum roll, yeah. No, I'm just so pleased with the idea that I can't. So I talked about being spring-loaded. I am a man who, I sponsor a number of guys. And one of the things that you get to do over a period of time is you just kind of watch patterns of thought of people that you run into. And in that process, you are gifted with the idea of starting to see patterns in your own thinking. You get to see evolutions of your own thinking. And what I see so often in the early guys, the primitive sort of thing, they're almost not aware that they're thinking. They just get an idea, and the idea is like imprinted on their eyeball, and it is their reality. They are in the play with the helmet, with the spear. There is nothing else. It is their reality. They are acting out this thought, an idea, as it goes through their mind, and there is no other thought, there is no other idea, there is no other choice. They are so involved in that reality. And when you have that conversation with them, it's all there is. There's no perspective. There is almost no place to have a conversation with someone who is in that kind of primitive, locked on, you know, sort of thing. They're feeding it back to you, and that's what it is. As time went on in my sobriety, I started to get a sense that I didn't always see things the way everybody else saw. I don't know where I got that, but I did start to get that. That's a new thought. That is a new thought. It never occurred to me, honest to God, that I didn't perceive things as they were. It never occurred to me. Now, it occurred to me that I made the wrong decision, but it never occurred to me that I perceived them as being different than they were. I thought, how the hell do you perceive them wrong? I mean, you're just there, you look at it, I'm just watching it. Okay? But it's very different. So I used to get a thought, and then I'd have a reaction. I was like a jukebox. You put a quarter in, you push B5. I played B5. You want to play B5? We'll play B5. Okay? I had no choice. It was mechanical. I was a monkey on a string. You pull the string, I danced. Now, what has happened over a period of time is I have become less identified with my mind and with my thinking. As Ken said, it's a tool. Okay, now, it has, for most of us, for most of our lives, been in charge. The tool has been in charge. The computer has been in charge. And now we start to have access to the mainframe. We do not have this little handheld job that we've been walking around with is not up to it. It's like bringing a knife to a gunfight. Now I have an opportunity for the first time. So today, I get a chance to observe my thinking. You understand that? Now, almost all of us from time to time have a chance to observe our thinking. Now, that's like having a gap. That's like having a space. I never had that space. Thought, action, thought, action, thought, action. Now there's a gap, and in the gap, I realize, first of all, I'm not the thought. And I'm not the thinker. I'm observing the thinker. When people start to sometimes have an experience of meditation, when I talked about silence being the language of God, there was a book called. There was a man called Rollo May, who was the son of Gerald May, who was the son of Rollo May, and he wrote a number of books. One of them called Spirit and Grace. That's not that funny. Not that funny. There will come a time in your development where you can actually have humor that doesn't have to be at the expense of someone else. I don't know. I don't know when that is, but I mean, I think that's nice.
Not today.
No, I know he wrote Addiction and Grace, but he also wrote this other book. But anyway, he talked about unitive moments. He talked about walking through the woods and coming to a glade and having an opening, and all of a sudden in that opening, there was just a total absence of thought, and you were one in being with the universe. And that many of us have had that in front of a mountain or at the ocean, or we have had what they call those unitive moments. That moment ends when you are there. That moment ends with you observing what you're doing, with your thinking about what you are doing. But in the moment, in that space, there is no thought. Meditation, one of the primary things that people try to do in meditation is to clear the mind, to stop the compulsive, obsessive process of thinking, to sink to the bottom, grab a hold of the weeds, and let the thoughts go by like boats on a river, because you can't absolutely always stop the process, but you can disengage from that process. So somehow I think in our spiritual path, you have to become, to some extent, more disidentified with your mind and with the thinker. To understand that it is a tool, that it is not who you are, that who you are is connected with the spirit, and that the thinker and the thinking is a tool and it is a process and it is not reality. That when you are connected to the knower, when you are connected to God, when you are connected to your source, to the being, to the spirit, there is a way of knowing and being. There is a grounding in that place that allows you to be with life and have it all be okay. In that space, there is a peace that is not conditional. And you are okay with whatever is. And when you are okay with what is there, you are able to be with it. And every ability that you have is then available in that process to you in the business of living your life. You are not living the drama that goes on in your head as an excuse for life. The soap opera is not your life. The circumstances of your life are simply the circumstances of your life. They are not your life. There is something that you are that is independent of that, that is independent of every circumstance in your life and is not conditioned on any circumstance in your life, that is beyond anything, that is deeply connected to the source of being and the source of life. And we know this, and when it is talked about at a moment, at a meeting, in a church, when you're in love, at a space, when we connect with that space, we may not have the words to describe what it is, but we know it.
In the back of the big book, in the medical opinion, medical view, I think it's Dr. Bauer, talks about the fact that if you're lucky in Alcoholics Anonymous, what will happen is you'll lose, and his words are, that excessive concentration on yourself. You'll begin to realize that the world doesn't have to work a certain way just for me to be happy. That it can work the way it's working and I can still be happy. As Bob said, it's not conditional anymore. The reality is that I can be happy regardless of what's going on. And, you know, all spiritual paths consist of four basic parts. And AA has those four basic parts, which is show up, pay attention, tell the truth, and don't be attached to the results. And if you can do those four things on a daily basis in all circumstances, you're in good shape. The problem with most of us is we don't like the results, so we're going to always work about changing the results. And pretty soon you find out it gets very exhausting trying to remake God's world. You know, we're supposed to do God's work and not his job. And sooner or later you realize that there's no mortgage on your life. You own it. So you better get busy doing something with it. You know, if you're not happy with the way your life is going, who's to blame? You know, it's amazing to me that people think there's somebody else at fault. You know, yeah, my life isn't working. Well, what are you doing? Well, it goes back to when I was a child and, you know, the Indians kidnapped me and, you know, I was held for ransom by lions, and you know, and that's why I remember taking my granddaughter to see the movie Lion King, and there was a scene in there where Simba was at the watering hole, and this great voice of James Earl Jones came down and said, "Simba, remember who you are. You're okay. You were always okay. You were sent out from the home office okay. The only time you have any real frustration or pain is when you're trying to resist the way it is." And it's not logical. In India, they tell the story about the guy who came home and his wife had hit the lotto. And he said, "How did you do that?" And she said, "I kept having this reoccurring dream, four sevens. So I bet 26 and I won." And he said, "But 4 sevens are 28. She said, "You be the mathematician. I got the money." You know? And that's the way life is, you know? It's not about the reality of the logic. There is no reality in logic. It's about just... the last movie I went to see was Titanic. And I said going in, I know how it ends. But the bottom line was when the person I went with, we watched this movie, Titanic, and when the movie was over, she said, "What did you think of that movie?" And I said, "You know, I kind of knew the ending coming in. The thing that really fascinates me is the screen." And she said, "There's nothing on it now." And I said, "That's what fascinates me. The fact that I came into this theater and I sat down and something came on that screen that completely held my attention for 3+ hours. And then when it was over, it went back to the original thing that was there, which was the screen. And it led me to believe that's the way God is working in my life. I'm running a film constantly, but God is there. The minute I turn the film off, I get to see God in all his glory. But my deal is that as soon as I turn it off, I know I cease to exist. And not wanting to cease to exist, I put on another film. I sell popcorn. You know, I run the concession stand. I evaluate the film. I get other characters to play in it. I have a supporting cast of thousands. But the deal is it's not a reality. The reality is the screen that's behind it. And then recently on TV, I had talked about seeing this movie, and when I talk about something, the guys I sponsor know I never go to the movie, so they call me up to watch this thing that was on about recovering the Titanic. And in that little educational thing, they showed this titanium bell that was going down to some great depth and how it had to be specially made with this little portal so it wouldn't be crushed by the water underneath. And it was made out of titanium. And when it got down to the bottom where the Titanic is, you saw all these little tiny fish swimming around. They weren't made out of titanium. And somehow they were surviving at that depth. Something was sustaining them that wasn't titanium. And that's the same thing that sustains me, the thing I can't explain, and the thing I don't need to explain. But the thing that I need to know, I don't need to explain. You know? It's really like when a rhinoceros is born, it's already reached the quintessence of rhinocerosity. It's not going to be any more rhino than it is that moment. But when a human being is born, we're just set on the path. And being set on the path, we have this great potential for growth. And that great potential for growth, as one of the great poets of our time wrote, said, "Life is the system whereby we lead you gently back to yourself, and you get to know who you are for the first time." That's what this is. This is a coming back to who we really are all along and seeing it for the first time.
No, I'll go. Which is what the epic journey is all about. Are you leaving because you're not interested, or are you? I didn't care, Ken. So you're led back to who you have always been. If I had a circle and drew a circle, and in that circle was everything there is to know, and I took a slice of pie out of that circle and says, "That's what you know. You know a portion of what everything there is to know." And then I took another slice and said, "This is what you don't know, and you know you don't know. So you don't know the theory of relativity. You know you don't know something about quantum physics. You know you don't know how to knit. You know you don't know, there are things you don't know." But the great bulk of the circle is what you don't know, and what you don't know, you don't know. Most everything that really makes a difference in life, and most everything that really makes a difference in spirituality, to me, has come from that part. It was something that I didn't know, and I didn't know it,
and it made all the difference in the world. And now I have one other thing to say about that. If you can't learn anything you don't know, there is already some level of knowing that when you hear something that is true, you go, oh, yeah. Now, at one level, you know you didn't know it before it was said. But once it was said and you interacted with it, there was a part of you that just said, yes. You knew that before you heard it. So both those things are kind of so. But the mind alone is not just not up to the task of what we need in life. It's a great junior partner, but it need not be in charge. And if it's in charge, if the mind and ego is in charge, we're in trouble. You have a whole system, a whole level of priority, a whole sense of separateness, a whole sense of difference, a whole set of animosity and hostility, and a sense of wanting to be right and make other people's wrong, wanting to dominate and avoid domination. There's a whole set of business that the ego and the intellect have together that are not the business of the spirit. And what we're looking for is something that is lasting. We're looking for a peace. We're looking for an answer. As Ken talked about, the answer is coming home to who we have always been. It is a round trip. The process of finding God is an inside process. It is not an outside process. So we've been looking in the wrong place with the wrong tool for the wrong thing. And everything in the world is telling us that that's what we're supposed to do. Now, we may have a sense, we may have some access, we may have some place where people say, look over here, look someplace else. But most of us are so busy that we don't have the time to do that. Most of us have tried a little of that and found it wanting, or had a problem in the area, ran into someone, started to go someplace and ran into someone who we thought didn't treat us right, or violated us, or wanted us to shave our head and sell books at the airport, or, you know, whatever it was. But we had a reason for why the process of a more specific search for a God, for a real connection, for the core. Okay? And I'm saying that that is what brings the meaning and the essence to life. It is the essence of life. And when we connect, there will be a part of us that goes, oh yeah. Oh yeah. This is, yeah. It's okay. It's all okay. We will be home. It will be all right. We will be all right. There will be nothing missing. We will be as strong as we have ever been. We will be able to act with great conviction and strength and freedom. We will be able to love without judgment or assessment. One of the things that is in our way of loving ourselves is the judgment that we have. In order to grow as we get older in life especially, and in order to confront some of the unworkability of our lives, you have to develop a sense of compassion. If you don't have a sense of compassion, you will not be able to look at the things in your life, the foibles, with enough gentleness to be able to be with them. But once we connect, there will be that kind of love, that kind of gentleness, that kind of openness, that kind of inclusion, the kind of non-judgmentality that will give us the access to that. And there will be nothing in the way. So the process that is the process that we are all on. And we may not even know that we are on it. We may have to remind ourselves from time to time that it is that we are really spiritual beings having a human experience, rather than human beings having a spiritual experience. We've got it backwards. The human part may be the junior partner. The spiritual part, the essence of it, that what we are here to do is to complete that trip. And that is what all the mythological journeys of all, you know, the great carriers of the mythology of our cultures which have tried to do, all of them have the message of that round trip in one way or the other. It's all okay, just the way it is. You have no place to go. You are as wonderful as you will ever be right this moment. Not in the reduction, in the small way that I'm saying that, is that there is more wonder about how you be today, and there is no place to go. You are already there. All the great masters of the world have said, you have it now. You are sitting on the box of gold. You just have not looked inside. You are looking outside.
There's a deal with that external part of us where, you know, I don't know how it works in Minnesota, but in California, the way it works is people get into meditating and vegetating, you know, and they chant and they rant, and they heal the child within, and they have their chakras, their auras, their cards, their hands, their feet red, you know. They take trips to Thailand and Tibet and China because they know God is opposed to indoor plumbing and